Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen out there. Today is August 19th, 2015. Welcome to this special edition of Scott Scope Talk Radio. I am your host, Scott Wilson, blogger and graffiti writer extraordinaire. On tonight's show, we're going to do something a bit different. Actually, a whole lot different. We are going to have a panelist on that has called in from time to time, so some of you may have heard her voice before, but she's someone who's very important to me and important to this show, and she has a very relevant and insightful perspective on the topic tonight. Tonight's topic is going to be one of the more negative aspects of NWA's legacy in light of all the hype and praise that Straight Outta Compton is receiving right now, and there's kind of been a reconsideration of their legacy in many circles. We touched on this on last night's show where we reviewed the film itself. As a lot of people know, I am an NWA fan. I'm also an Ice Cube and Dr. Dre fan heavily. I've been such since I was about 12 or 13. That hasn't really changed throughout the years. Some albums I like more than others. I like the early stuff way more than I like the later stuff, but for me, it's the same with pretty much any rapper I've ever liked. But tonight, I want to talk about sort of a lingering issue that keeps getting tabled every time rap fans and to a larger extent, black people try to have discussions about hip-hop, or honest discussions about hip-hop, rather. And I want to talk about the misogyny in NWA's work, the role that their impact and influence has played in terms of broadcasting that misogyny. I'm going to talk about Dre's history with domestic violence and assault and everything else. But I want to make it clear at the top of the show, this is not going to be a witch hunt. This is not going to be an hour-long session where I'm bashing Dr. Dre and NWA and accusing them of destroying hip-hop, because I do not believe they did that. That's a silly notion. It's an East Coast bias, New York bias notion that needs to die. Apparently, it has not. But I am going to hold them accountable for all aspects of their legacy on this show. And without further ado, I'm going to bring in tonight's co-host, E. Hill.
What's good, everybody?
Hey, E-Hill, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good myself. I've been looking forward to this show. It's something that, you know, I've had in the works for a few weeks now, and I think that this is the opportune time for it. I think this is the best time to have this discussion, because the furor and the joy over Straight Outta Compton is kind of at fever pitch right now. It's probably as loud and as big as it's ever going to get, because most movies just suffer some sort of a decline in their second weekend, even the biggest movies. It's very, very rare, almost unheard of these days, for a movie to increase in its second weekend. So right now is the best time to talk about this.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to try to, this discussion is going to be fairly free-flowing. The show is going to only be half the length of our usual shows.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want the discussion to be efficient and concise, and I want to hit most of the major points. But of course, this is a topic that you can't really encapsulate in one discussion, especially not one between two people. But having heard your thoughts about the matter, I think your thoughts are not only relevant but important, and I wanted to give you a platform to air them where you would be unhindered, and where people would, I don't want to say use the word forced, but people would be, I guess, compelled to hear what you have to say without a lot of background noise or without being able to conveniently block it out. So just tell me, what is your background or relationship with hip-hop and NWA in particular?
Well, before I answer that, which I will, I do want to start by saying a couple of disclaimers here. The first being that what I say on this show and anywhere else, because my message is fairly consistent, is a reflection of me and my life and time. It doesn't necessarily reflect the views of all black women. It doesn't necessarily reflect the views of all black women who are fans of hip-hop. And as we've seen, it doesn't reflect what the views of all black people. So I will start with that. I'll also start by saying that I am a fan of hip-hop. I've been listening to it for a long time. But I'm not a scholar of hip-hop. I'm a scholar, but I'm a scientist. But there are scholars, and there's a lot of scholarship in within the realm of what we're speaking of. I'll direct people to Dr. Tricia Rose, who's actually been fairly visible. A lot of her scholarly work is on 20th century African American or black culture, and she has a lot of foci and hip hop. Some of her most notable work is Black Noise, Rap Music and Black Culture in Contemporary America, Microphone Fiends, Youth Music and Culture, The Hip Hop Wars, What We Talk When We Talk About Hip Hop and Why It Matters. I'll direct people to Millis Harris Perry. Some know her as the host of the Melissa Harris Perry Show, but she's an actual scholar, and she wrote Sister Citizen. Some of you may be familiar with that. That publication has gotten critical acclaim. And Dr. Eric Nielsen of the University of Richmond has also done some work. Some of his notable stuff there, Here Come the Cops, Policing the Resistance in Hip-Hop, White Surveillance of the Black Arts, and these are all journal publications in progress or in print. So I'm not an authority on this, but there is some scholarship on it, so I direct people who have a knee-jerk reaction to what I'm saying or have any doubts that this is being studied. I just dispelled that. And the last thing I want to say before I answer your question is that this is not a message for misogynists. I'm not interested, closeted or outed. It doesn't make sense. I'm not trying to convince people that I'm right. I'm also not trying to convince people that they are wrong. But this is not a message directed at that particular group. I will refer them to their own circles and keep this discussion about my relationship with hip-hop and what I've learned through my scholarship on some parts of the subject and whatever. So my relationship with hip-hop, my earliest memory started with The Message from Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. My mother actually introduced me to that song. Many of you may not know, and may even draw the ire of many of you. And it'll explain a lot. My mother's a feminist scholar. And so she introduced me to this genre, which by and large was an outcropping of the Black Arts Movement. And so we would sing that in the car, and it was a bonding moment for us, and I loved it right then. I think what's kept me engaged over the years is the presence of women in hip-hop, the variety that there was that was available to hear mainstream at the time. And most recently, I've been able to kind of piece together a lineage of women in hip-hop. And being a Midwest kid, I grew up on the west side of Chicago. Some of you may know that. We didn't get, I think we got some of the filtered, the artists that were filtered out in New York and maybe some out of the West Coast, and then we finally heard them. So it's been interesting to piece together the lineage, particularly of women, and there are quite a few that really influenced some of the artists that people reference all the time. And so their presence in hip-hop really kept me engaged. And I was also drawn to the political message I come from. It. I have activist roots. And so it fit right in line with that activist tradition. And as with any relationship, it ebbs and flows. There were times that I wouldn't listen to it. There were times where I was fully immersed. Some of it was due to the content. Some of it, well, much of it was not necessarily the misogyny, but some of it was just whack. And I didn't want to hear it. But I was also into other music genres. But I've had a long-standing affair with hip-hop, and I still listen to it, more underground artists than any other, although if I find a mainstream artist I like, I'll listen to them and support them. So I think that best sums up my relationship with this.
Okay, now given everything you've just said, and that was a very, very detailed description of your relationship with hip-hop, so you clearly are familiar with the form, even if you're not like a scholar, as you say, or a practitioner, but you definitely understand it, and it's been a part of your life just like it's been a part of mine and all of the other ScottScope panel members. What has your relationship been with NWA in particular, and gangster rap, which is the form that they're most associated with, or which some people don't even like that term. They feel like it's a media-created term. But
right.
what's your relationship with them?
Well, initially, I didn't really have one. I think when they came out, we were, 13? I was, 13 or 14. First of all, it was like, you know, it was a no-go in my house, so it was like contraband. So I heard it from friends older siblings or whatever that had access to them. I think listening to, I don't think I was too bothered by Straight Outta Compton. I think Ice Cube's lyric in that, the first verse in that is like the hardest entry to a song ever. But as I started listening, I wasn't really a fan of Eazy-E. I had heard him a lot, and I'd heard what he said, and I just didn't really like it. I couldn't really put my finger on why, but I wasn't a fan of Eazy-E, and so therefore that disdain kind of permeated out to the rest of them when they really increased their popularity, because I didn't know what misogyny was, or, you know, I couldn't verbalize why I had this visceral feeling of yuck, but it was in a more juvenile form. And so I'd heard some tracks off of it, just through people, and they were bumping it. They were very excited about it, and I was just kind of like, meh. But one song I did know and did like was Express Yourself. I knew every lyric to that song. because it was a departure from all the other stuff that we're saying, and it seemed to evoke a more positive message. And I did like the sample. I thought it was an awesome sample. I grew up on the west side of Chicago. If anyone's familiar with that area of the city, it's hood. So stuff that really glorified the hood wasn't all that appealing to me, just because I didn't see the glamour in it. F the police, I mean, people were getting jacked up in Chicago too. I was introduced to the concept of the ghetto bird or helicopters rolling around everywhere, which didn't happen by and large in Chicago. So that was new. And just a different type of surveillance. But I just wasn't drawn to all of that. I was actually trying to distance myself at that time because I was becoming more aware of my femininity and, you know, more and societal gender roles and all that stuff. And it just ran counter to that and counter to the messages that my mother was giving me. So I didn't really want to, I listened to them in passing, and as their stuff got more and more just vile and degrading, I totally shut them down. I did listen to The Chronic. I did like The Chronic. And I did listen to Death Certificate. In fact, I believe Colorblind is on that. That's one of my favorite joints. But as far as the group itself, I didn't really feel connected to them. I felt their message was not for me. So therefore, I just kind of opted out, by and large, save a couple of songs in their discography.
Okay. Now, seeing as how you grew up in a certain neighborhood in Chicago, and you had sort of a, I don't want to say a ringside seat, because of the implications of that phrase, but you kind of had a front row seat to a lot of the things that their music touched on, or rather, a lot of the things that their music kind of threw in your face in a very brash way. How have you felt about the notion, the undying notion that they were basically just reflecting the reality of the streets or the hood, or reflecting the sentiments of the people who live there, and the indignities that those people had to suffer on a daily, because that notion has been used pretty much to defend and protect their music,
mm-hmm.
like every aspect of it. How do you feel about that?
Well, that's a really good question. First of all, I'll get to the actual answer, or what I'll try to attempt at, or what I think is an answer. But I think people have boiled these conversations. They've tried to take a very complex topic, and they've tried to, you know, put it in these little sound bites. And it's a really complex relationship between the hood and hood politics and gender roles and, you know, strained relationships with the police and all that stuff. And I think it's out of expediency, because these are conversations that have been happening piecemeal for, you know, ever, at least 30 years. So that being said, I think they were some of the things did resonate with at least people that I was in close contact with, which is why they supported them. They weren't really concerned about the misogyny of it. They were like, this is how we're living. They just happen to be on the West Coast. We just happen to be in the Midwest, but we still have, we both have this strained relationship and mistrust of the police. We still see banging and slanging and pimping as a way to financial prosperity, if dare I say freedom. So I think it did resonate with a lot of, and I hung around a lot of guys. One of my best friends was a guy, and he listened to that stuff all the time. So I think that's true. What I think is missing from that conversation, though, is it didn't reflect everybody. So I didn't, and certainly not the girls and women that I knew who did listen to hip hop. It's like, well, we kind of like the beats and we like that stuff, and we have to listen to this stuff, this other, you know, vile and degrading things in order to enjoy the music. And I think it was a real game changer as far as some of the people that I knew, their relationship with hip hop changed. And they did either one of three things. They either in the message was indoctrinated in them, and they acquiesced and said, okay, well, they talking about bitches and hoes, so I guess I better not be that, and then they won't be talking about me, knowing that there's no clear, knowing that that definition is highly subjective. Or they took on the persona of the people that were oppressing them. So they said, well, you know, if they say bitches and hoes, and I'm going to be like F niggas and say equally vile and degrading things about them. And so, and that's my inoculation from the pain of that other stuff. Or they just turned away from it altogether and just painted hip hop with a broad brush and said, oh, this is terrible. Without really knowing that hip-hop didn't start with N.W.A. And West Coast for me was not necessarily them. It was like J.J. Fad and Yo-Yo and Boss and the Far Side. So I certainly saw that West Coast rap was coming out with stuff, and they didn't ruin it for me, but they did. They pushed the boundaries at my expense, and I don't think I ever really reconciled that.
You know, there is a school of thought, and I knew this, you know, planning this show, not that I really care at all, but there's a school of thought that says that whenever you go against black people that seem to be successful, or if you critique any aspect of what they do, that you're a house nigga.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that school of thought, you know, it continues to this day. And in keeping with that, with albums like Straight Outta Compton, people see these albums as sort of relating the thoughts, feelings, and the struggle of "quote unquote" field niggas, and it's only the house niggas that are going to critique that in any way. Because if you critique any aspect of what the "quote unquote" field niggas are saying, then it's like you're pretty much negating their entire struggle. You've decided to side with the enemy, and you're turning your back to your brothers and sisters, and you're not, instead of helping them out, instead of, you know, echoing those sentiments, there's a notion that you should kind of be in league with that, regardless of what's said. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, and this is not a discussion limited to this movie. This just happens to be the topic of the month. But whenever issues like this come up with, like Floyd Mayweather, Ray Rice, or some prominent brother is being torn down seemingly by us, in a way, and it's really interesting because the same arguments these people use to defend these guys is the same arguments that white people use to defend their racism. And it's interesting to me that people don't see that. So when Ice Cube says only bitches and hoes should be offended by our music then and now, that's equivalent to what white people are saying. Only niggas should be offended by what we say and do, police brutality and all that, because we're talking about them, right?
Very good point.
So who defines them, right? Who defines them? So where does the definition start and end? And so a lot of the misogyny that it tracks with the racism. And this has been going on for years and years and years, and it's really rooted in the notion that we want to push this message of black empowerment, but we want to keep the patriarchy intact as we're doing that, and the patriarchal structure of this mandates that if you have any voice of dissent with respect to black men, in some, especially prominent black men in some way, shape, or form, then that's an act of aggression, like using your agency to defend your black body or your black woman's body. Is seen as an act of aggression, and it's violently suppressed in many cases. And hip hop is just one of many domains where this happens. You see it in gaming. You see it in social activism. You see it in
You definitely see it in mainstream movies. That's always been there.
In movies, so there's this violent suppression, almost and vehement defense of these people. But if we said that David Duke, who was a prominent member of the Klan, and he was in the spotlight maybe 20-25 years ago, if he was a changed man and decided that he wanted to be a rap artist, former like head Klansman, that's his past, right? You would have men, women, and children, you know, saying, "Oh hell no," right? Irrespective of his past or irrespective of what he is now, his past overshadows much of what he's trying to do now, and to not acknowledge that would be inauthentic. And so, as I've been speaking with people about this, men and women alike, in the movie, there's a thought. I haven't seen the movie, but there's this thought that there's a lack of authenticity when you omit this large part of their discography and their message from their story. Because if you grew up with it like we did, we know that it's there. And the part that they focused on, their rise and their, you know, from poverty and their F the police message was a small part. And then there was other parts like the drug dealing and the misogyny that made up a large part of their discography. And so if people want to have authentic discussions about who the dissenting voices are and why. And it's really a product of, you know, us using our agency as women or supporters of women. And people who are very dogmatically clinging to these patriarchal traditions. Like, you can't use your agency. They're the ones that are going to, you know, call us, you know, house niggas and all that. I mean, I've been called a lot worse, but that's really what's at the root of this whole discussion is you being empowered to use your agency to hold these men accountable for what they do. All of it. And then, I don't know, maybe some people are looking for an act of contrition. Maybe in some small measure I was too. I mean, these men are like close to 50. They've got wives, they've got daughters, they might even have grandkids on the way or something. And so they've lived long enough to have developed these different types of relationships with women, but they're about that life. They still talking about a bitch is a bitch. And so it's like this thing doesn't evolve, at least not in this case, with these with the surviving members of this group. And that sorry, not sorry from Dre is insufficient. If you can't bring yourself to say, I'm sorry for blah, 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 I mean, that speaks a lot to your character, to me. And then it goes without saying, if you read the Rolling Stone article with Cube, that goes without saying. So,
okay, at this juncture, because we're a little bit over the halfway point, a couple minutes, but I think we may have to go into overtime because, as I said at the beginning of the show, I'm starting to notice this can't be contained in 1 hour-long discussion, and Ms. Hill has her views really are opening up Pandora's box, so to speak, but in a very positive way. I kind of feel like you have to be a scholar just to sort of contend with a lot of the things you brought to the table. And that's a good thing, because this stuff is supposed to test our intelligence. It's not supposed to just engage our emotions, which is like, I know that's supposedly the idea behind all art, is that it's supposed to engage the emotions first. Because I forget who made that quote, or what the quote exactly was, but it's like, at the end, all that matters is how you made them feel. And I think a lot of artists and art critics kind of go by that notion that, you know, everything else is secondary to that. But the number for the show tonight is 347-215-7756. Again, that's 347-215-7756. It's just us two panelists here tonight, but if anybody wants to engage Ms. Hill on what she is saying, and you better, like EPMD said, you better bring your shield and your armor, because it's not gonna be easy. I'm gonna offer, this has turned into more of an interview than a discussion, but I think your thoughts and feelings on this matter they don't really need, at least not for the purposes of this particular podcast, they don't really need a counter voice or whatever, because this podcast is meant. This is a domain of men. I didn't design it as that consciously. To a degree, I did, but for the most part, no. But you always get a men's perspective here, so I think it's kind of important to get a different perspective on this. And just to let people know, my evaluation of the film is that, you know, I like the film. I think it's a phenomenal first half, followed by a so-so second half. And yeah, a lot of my feelings about that is powered by nostalgia, and is powered by the fact that I've been an NWA fan since day one. At this point, I can't even count how much money I've put into the bank accounts of both Dr. Dre and Ice Cube.
And I think people should acknowledge that, you know, we wouldn't even be having this discussion if they didn't sell records. And they had the engine that powered them were white folks that had money. And they peddled these messages for profit. And so we can hold them accountable for what they said, but it could have stayed in their basement if it wasn't, or wherever they wrote it. But it didn't. It was worldwide, and I did listen to them. And I don't want to say that they are they single-handedly destroyed hip-hop, because they didn't. I mean, I think that's an unfair assessment. I think it's wrong-headed and conflated, because their message, though offensive to me as it wasn't the first time I'd heard it by any stretch. And dare I say, and someone can definitely correct me on this, but KRS-One, when he, you know, said Roxanne Shanté was good for steady fucking.
Yeah.
And he was arguably one of the most conscious rappers alive.
And it goes deeper, because on that album Criminal Minded, which came out in 87, a year before Straight Outta Compton, there were some examples of gangster rap. There's, of course, everybody knows 9mm Goes Bang, and even the name of the album and on the cover art, him and Scott LaRock are, you know, they're draped in truck jewelry and they're holding automatic weapons.
Yeah.
You know,
the responsibility and just the Black Arts Movement and the Black Power Movement in and of itself was male-dominated and misogynist. And you can ask anybody, any scholar of that, and they will corroborate that. So it was born out of all these different activist roots and arts roots, and they all had misogyny as part of that, as part of the fruit of that tree. And so this movie has zero in on N.W.A. and Dr. Dre and Cube, since they're still alive and they can answer for this stuff. Whereas you do a biopic on James Brown or Marvin Gaye or Miles Davis, you know, they can't answer for this stuff anymore. They're dead. So rest in peace. So I don't think it's right. And I tell people, I don't condemn people who enjoy this film. I enjoy F. Gary Gray. I love Set It Off. I love The Italian Job. But I'm not going to be made to answer for my lack of support for the film. And it's not necessarily a reflection of how good or bad it is. I think as time has gone on, and this, you know, this vehement, I mean, some of the things I've read are just, they're just, oh my God, vile. Some of the things I've read about, you know, the women who have come forward or have written or blogged about this, it's just diminished my enthusiasm considerably for the film.
And I want to not to stop you dead in your tracks right here, but I want to there's some things I want to make sure to touch on just for the sake of clarity, so that people understand exactly where you're coming from. You may have answered this already to a degree, but I want to just again make it clear and emphasize, you know, what there are people who feel, and you know, and it's not even a matter of people who feel, it is the truth that Black men and Black artists and entertainers, Black public figures, are often singled out for misogyny among pretty much every other crime under the sun. We're, you know, our behavior is scrutinized as Black men much more harshly than our white counterparts. For example, I mean, we can run the list and run the gamut. Sean Connery, very famously on the Barbara Walters show, and I was a kid and I saw this. I think it was this show, because she used to do those pre-Oscar ceremony shows. Sean Connery was nominated for The Untouchables, for playing Malone in The Untouchables. I think he won. Mm-hmm. but this aired right before the telecast, he admitted that he has no problem giving a woman a good slap. He said a woman needs a good slap, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. Everybody, and you know, it hasn't really affected his career at all.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's kind of part of his mystique and mythos. The Bond character, those early Bond, you know, James Bond is one of the single most misogynist characters of all time, and not just because he's promiscuous or he's a player, mm-hmm. but, you know, especially Ian Fleming's novels, the misogyny goes much deeper to a very to an intentionally disturbing level. In Ian Fleming's mm-hmm. novels, Bond is not really the quote-unquote good guy in the same way he is in the movies. He's kind of a much more like a Jason Bourne type character. There's mm-hmm. a lot of gray area there, and you know, it's not as easy to side with him. But in the movies, mm-hmm. yeah, he slaps women around. Sean Connery's done that. There's a member of Led Zeppelin. I think, I don't want to say Jimmy Page because I don't want to get the story too screwed up.
I think it was.
Yeah, he held a young girl hostage because mm-hmm. he wanted to have sex with her. He did not want to go to jail or get found out, and he held her hostage for an extended period of time. And I can't remember mm-hmm. exactly the period of time, but I remember reading about this, and it was... This is pretty much a fact. It's something that's known. Everybody knows about Roman Polanski, and, mm-hmm. you know... He's a fugitive from justice as we are recording this. He's a fugitive from mm-hmm. from justice. And
yeah.
there was a petition not too long ago which contained the names of some of my very, very favorite filmmakers and stars and screenwriters and Hollywood personalities to exonerate him. And this mm-hmm. is mainly on the basis of three things: of him being a great artist, which I don't understand. There's no moral prism for being a great artist. You know, that's not part of the equation. Also that the crime happened so long ago, and also because in other countries and cultures, having sex with teenage or quote unquote underage girls is not as much of a crime. But anyway, yeah, there's tons of examples. I could go on and on. Tons of examples of famous white men and white icons who have mistreated, abused, raped, and beat women. And this is known, and they are not taken to task in the same way that we black men are. And there are many people who feel that by bringing up Dre's past with Michelle A and Dee Barnes, and by bringing up the misogynistic portion of N.W.A.'s lyrics, that you would be perpetuating that same racism and that same self-hate. What are your feelings on that? I know that was a long-winded question, but I had to.
No. No. First of all, so then this touches on the complexity of the intersection of race and gender, right? So, I mean, I've been around. I live in Iowa. I went to predominantly white schools. All of my collegiate and graduate career, I've been around a lot of white people. Needless to say, and when white people call these men to task, and we can say Floyd Mayweather and Ray Rice and all these sports figures, they readily discuss that, and it's not necessarily on to advocate for black women and the black, you know, the black woman's safety and her sense of well-being. It's to attack these men. This is ammunition to attack the character of these men and solidify the dangerous black man narrative that they want to continue to perpetuate, right? And so if you're a thinking person, you do realize that if this is a part of your history or a part of your character in some way, shape, or form, it will be used to bolster this dangerous black man narrative. But it's not done to advocate for black women. And so the segment of black women, and let me go ahead and say this once and for all, for those who want to use the word feminist without really knowing what it is and what feminism is and means, everybody ain't no feminist. men and women can be feminists, but every act that says, every question about the destruction of the black woman's body is not necessarily born out of feminist ideology. And it's interesting to me that people who know nothing about feminism at all want to use the term and speak on it as if they do. There's a whole area of scholarship about it, and I'll direct you. You can call me or Facebook me, and I'll direct you to, I'll give you 10 names right off the bat. But back to the issue of when black women talk about how they've been impacted by the lyrics or the actions or whatever, we are advocating for an acknowledgement in some way, shape, or form. And it's really born, and you know, a lot of women, you know, want to stick with this strong black woman narrative, and we don't feel pain and all of that nonsense. It's not true. It's painful when we're going to the mat for black men, and we're being left hung out to dry. When it's and not only hung out to dry, but being the objects of your rage, that's hurtful, and it feels like a betrayal. And so that's what you're seeing from this sector of women bloggers and journalists and all of that stuff. And a lot of these women grew up listening to hip-hop, and they became writers and lawyers and executives and policymakers, and so they can take these men to task because they have a platform for it, whereas when they were little kids, they didn't, and it was easy to suppress these questions, right? But now they're running companies, they're running A&R, they're running stuff. And so there's a bigger platform, and so I think that's part of the difference. I think there are more outlets for these questions. You know, anybody can start a blog and write about it. And so I don't think that we're doing it to bring black men down. The success of Dre and Cube survived those incidents. I mean, clearly. But to even bring the question and have a vehement suppression of it, even now, is really baffling to me, particularly as we're, you know, going through this Black Lives Matter and Black Women's Lives Matter, and we were gaining some ground toward reconciliation of the acknowledgement of women's struggles in this police brutality thing, and we just took a big, huge step back in that conversation when we started talking about this movie, because they're in the movie, from what you've told me and what I've heard, they're addressing police brutality, the response to it in their music. And so it's very timely, and I don't think it's an accident that it came out in these days and time. But it's still, we're going backward in the conversation of how women are... The women's role in voicing our role in the fight, but also what we deal with as part of being part of the oppressed group. So we're not tearing down black men when we're asking them to acknowledge and somehow rectify the rift that was caused, the damage that's been done and it's continuing to be done with these terrible lyrics and blogs and videos and all these really hyper-sexualized and disembodied images of us, when by and large we're not like that at all.
Okay, now we're coming down to the 10-minute we got 10 minutes left, but like I said, we're going to go into a little bit of overtime. The call-in number is 347-215-7756. Again, that's 347-215-7756. And you're going to have to use that number if you want to listen in past 9 o'clock, because at that point, the show is no longer going to be broadcast. You'll only be able to listen in if you call in. I'm going to repeat it again at about 2 or 3 minutes to 9. Now, what I'm going to do in a minute, I'm going to move the conversation more toward Dre's actual behavior outside okay. of... Because at the end of the day, I think it can be acknowledged by everyone that most rappers, be they positive, negative, or indifferent, neutral, don't live what they talk about. Most of them, it's just really whatever persona they choose for themselves is a matter of branding, even if it's a positive persona. Even most conscious rappers are no different from quote-unquote gangster or reality rappers in that sense. Conscious rappers do what they do largely because they realize it's something they can sell and it may work for them. But before I ask that question about Dre, I want to ask the question, and again, you may have answered it before, but I want to make it clear for everybody who's listening. What would you say to the people who would say, let's take racism out of the equation, and let's, for the people who say, look, American society as a whole is misogynistic and treats women poorly. Every form of pop culture, every medium we have, every entertainment medium, there's misogyny in politics, there's misogyny on television, there's misogyny in rock music, R&B music, opera. There's not one thing that does not exude misogyny on some level. Why single out hip hop, and in particular, why single out these guys right now?
Well, I think hip hop has been the whipping boy or girl for this since its inception. I think people are just used to pointing to it now. But as far the second part of that answer with respect to the movie and why are these guys being held accountable, that's a pretty easy question because they're the topic of discussion today. So they put themselves and their body of work back into the mainstream domain. So that's why people are reassessing it, because it's back in people's consciousness like that. As far as taking racism out of the equation, when you're a black woman, you cannot do that. And so that's but even if we did, and we acknowledge that that misogyny permeates many aspects of American society, that's not licensed to not challenge that. That's not a valid reason to say this is not acceptable, to talk about decapitating women and throwing their bodies in the trunk. I don't care if it's Led Zeppelin or the Beatles. They will be called to task, particularly by white women. So, and therein lies the, distinctions within feminist circles. The intersection of race and gender is pretty inextricable. And so, you can't talk about a black woman's experience without talking about black men. We have relationships with black men. And by and large, many of us want to somehow heal those relationships and maintain them. But as long as there's this wall of mistrust and hurt and pain and all of that stuff, that reconciliation is nearly impossible. And when you violently suppress the discussions about it, it just deepens that divide even further. So I can't speak for all black women, but I can speak for myself. I'm not you know, I can call white men to task on what they do, and I have called white men to task on what they do, for the gender thing and the race thing. But at the end of the day, I'm deeply invested in black culture and black men. And so I want those relationships to be better, and I want our music and our art to reflect that. And I don't think it's unreasonable to want that.
Okay, and we're at 5 minutes to nine mark. Again, I'm going to repeat the number.
So,
215-7756. Again,
that's it. That's what I get. I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
Oh, I'm sorry. my microphone was misplaced, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry, the number, in case and nobody heard me, is 347-215-7756 if you want to continue listening past 9 o'clock. Again, it's 347-215-7756 if you want to continue listening past 9 o'clock, because you will not be able to hear it online. It won't be broadcasting anymore. Or you're going to have to download it after the fact. But one thing I want to talk about also is Dre's... I just thought of another question, important question to ask, before I get into Dre's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
The notion was brought up on the show last night by a caller and by one of the Scottscope Roundtable that... a lot of the furor over Dre's behavior, over the supposed negative impact of NWA's music on rap music as a whole and on the masses that listen to it, a lot of that furor is just thinly veiled jealousy from the Northeast, particularly New York and New Jersey, over the success of NWA in the West Coast. And you know, sort of this sort of a lingering jealousy that's been there ever since the West Coast emerged as a force to be reckoned with in rap music, and for quite a few years took the spotlight away from the East. And before you answer, I'm going to say yes, that jealousy was and apparently is very real, and there are New Yorkers that are out there doing that. But that notion was raised on the show last night. Now, what do you think about that?
Well, I'm a Chicagoan, so, you know, I really don't care. But at the end of the day, it's a means of suppressing the argument. It's a means of saying this is not a valid criticism of these people. And it just, that's just the form that it had last night. It takes on many forms. Some people call you, you know, a sellout. Some people call you these particular people couched it as being jealous or whatever. When it's really just a suppression of, at least with the argument for the against the misogynist discussions and stuff. I think that's what that was, and obviously I don't agree with it. So.
Okay, and like I said, I just wanted to put that out there because it is a part of this whole topic and this whole discussion, and it was something that was raised on the show last night. And like I said, I didn't want to go down that particular road because I didn't want to start that part of the discussion yet. But again, we got 20 seconds left on the air. But we're going to be continuing after 9 o'clock. So the call-in number is 347-215-7756. For those who want to listen past 9 o'clock, that's 347-215-7756. So in about 5 seconds, you're going to have to call that number to continue listening. Thanks.
Peace and love. Peace and love.
Okay. So now, to continue on. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. Some behind-the-scenes issues again. E. Hill, you still with me? E. Hill? One second, ladies and gentlemen. We are having some technical difficulties here. I think we lost E. Hill there for a moment, but until she calls back in, we are going to, I'm going to kind of continue the dialogue a bit until she calls back in. Like I said, I felt the need to do this show because I think that this is a part of the discussion that's being completely lost, and we need to get back to it. One moment, ladies and gentlemen. I am back, ladies and gentlemen. We are having some technical difficulties here, so we may indeed have to end the conversation, end the discussion now, perhaps maybe pick it up later on this week. I don't know. On tomorrow night's show, we're going to be talking to David Walker, the man, the writer behind the series Cyborg for DC. He's also going to be writing some Marvel titles. He wrote the Shaft comic for, I believe it's Dynamite Comics, and he's also got some novels coming. He has a Shaft novel coming, or maybe it's in release already, but he's going to be on tomorrow night. But to just sort of wrap things up here, I don't even know if this is recording anymore. Just sort of wrap things up here. I'm in agreement with a lot of what Ms. E. Hill had to say. I honestly believe that, you know, we've reached a point where people just don't want to have a dialogue about certain things anymore, or at least not an honest dialogue. And, you know, I'm a connoisseur of pop culture, as a lot of people on this show who know me or who are on this show and who know me and who listen to me and listen to my thoughts and feelings about things, they know how much pop culture I consume, movies, books, comics, magazines, YouTube videos, you name it. And a lot of these things are, you know, they have the same issues that hip-hop has. But I have no problem admitting that about the other things I consume. And I think it's time we started to admit this about hip-hop. But, yeah, I think we're pretty much going to have to close the show out at this juncture. So I'm going to have to thank everybody who tuned in tonight. Thank Ms. E. Hill for doing this show with me, this hour-long show. I should have programmed in more time, and I see that now. But I want to thank her for being here, and we will see you next time on Scott Scope.